there is a story of trust and virtue contained in the pages of Genesis. And whether our fondest memories of this story may have been as children, perhaps at a time when our parents shared it with us, or perhaps our encounter came or occurred later on in life, but we know it as a wonderful account. It's a wonderful account that began in sorrow, but ended in delight. It's the story of Joseph, and it's a story that teaches us no matter what age we are or what condition we find ourselves in. For in the account, we see that Joseph experienced severe and unexpected changes to his world. Yet, just as affliction did not sink him into despondency, neither did prosperity destroy his humility and trust in God. In the course of this message, we're going to see something in the pages of our Bible. We will see an exhibition of the wisdom and the power of God, an exhibition which brings good from intended evil, where God overrules envy and hatred, and in a powerful way, he turns the course of events according to his will. And it demonstrates something. It demonstrates the promise that all things work together for good, for those who love God, for those who are the called according to his purpose. The title of this message today is Trust, Virtue, and Waiting. Trust, Virtue, and Waiting. I'd like for us to begin the story of Joseph by spending some time on the background of the family, because the family dynamics are an important element of the account. Joseph's father was Jacob, Jacob being the grandson of Abraham and the son of Isaac. When Jacob was a young man, he was visiting relatives and noticed a girl named Rachel. And as the story goes, he fell in love. If the story ended here, we might think that they would have gotten married and lived happily ever after. But it doesn't end here. Rather, it gets complicated. Rather complicated. Jacob wants to marry Rachel, and Laban, Rachel's father, agrees to it if Jacob would work 7 years for him, which Jacob did. But Laban orchestrates a switch with Rachel's older sister Leah on the wedding day. So Jacob ends up with Leah as his wife, which is a complication to say the least. In the course of the festivities, Jacob apparently didn't pick up on the fact who the bride was as she was wearing a veil. But Jacob, still wanting to marry his beloved Rachel, is induced to work another 7 years for Laban in order to marry Rachel. But his marriage to Rachel occurs only 7 days after he married Leah. And we find that Jacob favors Rachel over Leah. So things continue to get even more complicated. Then the kids arrive. First, there's Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah through Leah. Then there is Dan and Naphtali through Rachel's handmaiden Bilhah, as Rachel, barren at the time, gave her to Jacob in marriage so Rachel could raise children through her. Then there was Gad and Asher through Leah's handmaid Zilpah, as Leah gave up childbearing temporarily. And then there was Issachar, Zebulun, and Dinah. They were born to Leah, Dinah being the only daughter of Jacob. But then God remembered Rachel, and she gave birth to Joseph, and later Benjamin as well. It's a big family. It's a big family and not without challenging dynamics. Yet history records that Jacob's name would be changed to Israel, and Joseph and his brothers would become the patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. But Joseph, the 11th son of Israel, or Jacob, is shown in Scripture to be his father's favorite, and it would complicate things on even a grander scale. Sibling rivalries and jealousies brought the young Joseph considerable trouble. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 37, because within this complicated family situation is where our story really begins. At this time, Joseph is 17. He is identified as a delight to his father. Genesis 37 records that Jacob dearly loved Joseph more than he loved his other children. And as a token of his affection, he gave Joseph a richly embroidered coat, a coat of many colors. Let's pick it up in verse 1 of Genesis 37. It says, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him, and could not speak peaceably to him. So the gift of the coat didn't exactly endear Joseph to his brothers. They knew he was their father's favorite, so seemingly and perhaps inevitably, his brothers began. They began to hate him. There's certainly a lesson for us today in this regarding favoritism. You know, Jacob may have had a special love for Joseph, but to openly demonstrate it as he did with a coat of many colors was such a badge of distinction, it did by no means promote peace and harmony in the family. A special love like this for one member of a family or a few at the expense of others can really hurt and alienate them. It can be a hard thing. And to add fuel to the fire, we read in verse 2 that Joseph also brings a bad report of some of his brothers to Jacob. Now, when a sin is reported, it's likely to do one of two things. Either the sinner will show remorse, will have a soft heart, or it will irritate and inflame them. And as we add up the events going on here, it's not surprising. It's not surprising that Joseph's brothers regarded him with deeper hostility. It is by no means an excuse for their behavior, but then again, not entirely surprising given the course of events. But the hatred seemed to be carried to its highest point with open malice and a deliberate desire for revenge when Joseph related to his brethren two dreams that expressed a common meaning. And the dreams intimated that all of his father's house would fall down and be in submission to him, that Joseph would reign over them. Let's read verse 8 of Genesis 37. And his brother said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. In the second of the two dreams, the vision included not only his brothers, but it included his parents as well. Let's read their reaction in verses 10 and 11. Genesis 37, 10 and 11. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So Jacob rebuked Joseph, but thereafter he reflected. He reflected on his son's dream. In earlier years, he too had received a dream from God. However, Joseph's brothers did something else. They envied him. You know, when we consider envy, it's an obsession that's restrained by very few barriers. Once envy takes hold of someone, it is a catalyst that can promote all sorts of enormous crimes. It caused Joseph's brothers to forget pity, to forget humanity, and we will see fostered a desire by at least some of them to take his life, to plot his death. And in history, we see that envy was at the very core of the first murder recorded in the Bible when Cain slew Abel. And so the brothers of Joseph soon found an opportunity to satisfy their vengeance. They were gone from home to provide pasture for their flocks, apparently for an extended period of time. And Jacob, being concerned for them, sent Joseph to see how they were doing and bring back a report. And so Joseph takes his father's request seriously. First tries to find them in Shechem, and not finding them there, went on to Dothan. And by the way, scholars say it's probably somewhere between a 50 and a 65-mile journey to go out and do that. Let's turn to verse 18 of Genesis chapter 37 and see what kind of reception he had. Genesis 37, 18. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Then they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he," that is Reuben, "might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." And sure enough, Joseph is stripped of his coat. He is thrown into the pit. But the plotting continued. Actually, it continued while they sat down to eat a meal. You just can't help but consider how barbaric and how callous all of this was. Here they are sitting around, eating a meal, contemplating how to destroy their brother. I think we should do such and such. Gad, will you please pass the olives? You know, how detached do you have to be to get to this point? This is all premeditated at this point. You know, very detached, very callous. But, as the story goes, another opportunity availed itself, and it was decided that Joseph's sentence of death would be changed into that of servitude and perpetual banishment. Joseph is sold for 20 shekels of silver to a band of Ishmaelite traders on their way to Egypt. Joseph is sold into slavery. And in an attempt to cover their crime, they took the robe of Joseph and dipped it in the blood of a goat, thereby convincing Jacob that a wild beast had killed Joseph. Perhaps Joseph's brothers, some or all, thought they might get away with it. Even Reuben, who sought to preserve Joseph's life, later is complicit with covering up the crime when Joseph is sold into slavery. But truth be told, there is no sin that God is not aware of. We read in Numbers chapter 32 and verse 23, if you want to write it down, that where there is sin, the sin will find you out. It will find you out. It will be revealed. Use as many tricks, pretense, or other clever ploys that you might invent, but iniquity will not stand. It will not stand. You know, we find in this life that people may seemingly get away with something. It may seem like for a very long time, or what may seem indefinitely. But God asks us to look at this from a very different perspective, with the perspective that He sees all and He knows all. Someone may think they can escape their sin, but with God there is judgment, and He governs the timing of that judgment. So Joseph's brothers, what did they do? They took matters into their own hands. They did not trust God to work things out. They certainly did not stand for virtue, and they failed their test. They failed their test. So the 37th chapter of Genesis ends with two things. An inconsolable Jacob, a man plagued by the knowledge he thought to be true regarding the loss of his beloved son, and Joseph is sold into slavery. But does the story end here? Does it end here? Does it simply end with God delivering Joseph from death, from God overruling the death sentence that at least some of his brothers wanted to play out, and from there have Joseph serve a lifetime of bondage? Does it end with Jacob in his despondency, crying out, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning"? Does it end this way? Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 40. You might want to hold your place in Genesis, but let's turn to Isaiah chapter 40. Because circumstances in life can cast doubts. They can cast doubts, but God asks us, as He asked for Joseph, to hold it aside. There is a recognition of and trust in the power and might of God that is required of us, as it was with Joseph. Let's pick up in verse 25 of Isaiah chapter 40. It says, "To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal?" says the Holy One. "Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things. Who brings out their host by number, He calls them all by name. By the greatness of His might and the strength of His power, not one is missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, 'My way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God'? Have you not known, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary? His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, He increases strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint." A relationship with God requires a trust in God. A faith we all must cultivate, that God's mercy, His love, His care is all in place. It's all in place. And that should help us recognize something. That in every Egypt, there is an Exodus. that in every den of lions there is a Lord who can shut the mouth of the lion, and that for every grave there is a resurrection, and for every temptation God provides a way of escape. Let's turn now to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis chapter 39. I get some of this water here. It certainly didn't end for Joseph. We do not find him in some kind of tailspin of bitterness and despondency. To the contrary, he apparently stood his ground for God, trusted in God, was virtuous with his moral grounding. And he displayed all of this in spite of being in such adversity, such a hard situation. Genesis 39, let's pick it up in verse 1. It says, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was, from the time that he made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." I'm just going to stop there for a moment. So Joseph is blessed by God, even in the condition of being a servant to Potiphar. And he is elevated to the highest position a slave could hold, that of overseer. You know, whether in good times or in difficult times, we are never invited by God to give up. Never. To the contrary, like Joseph, we're directed to serve to the best of our abilities, demonstrate our convictions in what we do. Just as we read in Ecclesiastes, that whatever our hands find to do, we do it with all our might. Nothing on there that says do it with all your might when you feel like it. Whatever your hands find to do. It's a fundamental truth that we find in Scripture, that it is God who raises us up. It is God who opens those doors. And he does it in a way that he chooses at a time of his choosing. And in the process, we're to find contentment. We're to find contentment in the process. Staying the course, serving to the best of our abilities. And as the case may be, and certainly as the case it was for Joseph, to wait on God. In the latter part of verse 6, it says that Joseph was handsome. If we were to read on, we would see that Potiphar's wife took notice of that fact and tried to put the moves on him and seduce him. But Joseph was not about to succumb to that. He was not about to sin against Potiphar. Certainly not his wife, and most importantly, not sin against God. As the story continues, she becomes more aggressive. At one point, she grabbed his garment, and Joseph was compelled to flee. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, actually verse 18, it talks about how we're supposed to flee sexual immorality. And the concept there is not about casual avoidance. I mean, what is being suggested here is what's displayed by Joseph. It literally may require circumstances that require someone to actually run, to get out of there, to actually run. But Potiphar's wife, she ends up using the garment as a means to accuse Joseph of something he did not do. She accuses him of sexually assaulting her. We might ask, well, why didn't Joseph just push her away? And he forcibly removed her hands from him. That way he could have kept the garment. He's probably physically stronger than her. Why didn't he do that? But we need to understand something. Joseph was a slave. And as a slave, he wasn't even permitted to touch Potiphar's wife. That would be crossing the line. So Joseph is not only obeying God's commands here. He's fully obeying his master Potiphar, even in such a distressing situation as this. But even in a situation like this, even an accusation An accusation like this against a slave would have typically meant the death sentence. Slaves didn't have rights. Yet we see in verse 20 of Genesis 39 that Potiphar spares Joseph's life. Joseph's life is spared and he's put into prison. Why was Joseph's life spared? Did Potiphar doubt the account he heard from his wife? Did God cause Potiphar to show mercy? Well, regardless of how it actually happened, God's hand is in the deliverance. He is delivered. Let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. In this life, there are countless thousands who would not pass or have not passed a similar test as what Joseph encountered. It is unfortunately as if it were the expectation, even among many of those who profess to know and follow God, that somehow they need to first experience this world, the life, the pleasures of it, before committing to God. As if it were somehow part of the plan to live somewhat of the life of the prodigal son in wasted life and inheritance before they bring themselves to a place of despair and then perhaps choose God. But Ecclesiastes 11 and in verse 9 says something very, very clear. Let's read it there. Ecclesiastes 11, 9. It says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these, God will bring you into a judgment." Joseph was a very young man at this time. He's a young man. The test of virtue, the test of morality, does not necessarily fall upon us at a time of our choosing. Doesn't necessarily happen in a manner that we dictate how it's tested. The issue is, what do we do? What do we do when we're given the test? What will we do? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, you can write down verse 13 if you'd like, we read that no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Virtue is not just the claim of holding a moral conviction. It's the measure of character in our actions. It's the measure of what we do. And Joseph demonstrated that character, clearly demonstrated it. Let's continue now back in Genesis. Let's go to Genesis chapter 39. Joseph made a choice. He chose to sacrifice reputation, liberty, and life rather than wound his conscience and offend the Lord. He is accused of a crime in which he hates, and he has no human path to vindicate his innocence. Yet there is no record of any complaint from him. So we find that Joseph is thrown in prison. Let's continue in Genesis chapter 39 and see what happens. We'll pick it up in verse 21. And it says, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper." So even in prison, Joseph is raised up. He is promoted. He is elevated to prison trustee. Have you ever been unjustly accused of something and suffered the penalty? Would we, like Joseph, stay the course, endure the hardship? Would we, like others through history that is recorded in the Old Testament and the New, trust in God? Most importantly, would we remember? Would we remember Jesus Christ, our Redeemer? Would we remember how he was treated? Would we remember what he endured? Would we place our confidence in him to plead our case? Would we do these things? Joseph had to wait. Joseph had to wait. We find that the next incident recorded in Scripture was when a couple of Pharaoh's servants somehow offended him and were put into prison. When we account for the time Joseph was in Potiphar's service, as well as the time that he was in prison, it is about 11 years at this point. 11 years. A long time to wait. Yet, as we will see, Joseph had to wait even longer. You know, it's interesting to note that Joseph didn't have a Bible to read while he was in Egypt. Clearly, God was with him, was teaching him, was guiding him. Yet you'd have to think that Joseph also would have relied on the memories of godly principles and the legacy of teachings from Abraham and Isaac and from his father Jacob and what they taught him. And Joseph applied and honored these teachings while being in bondage so far away. As we continue to see the events unfold, we read in Genesis chapter 40 about how the chief of the butlers and chief of the bakers had offended Pharaoh. Their names and their crimes are not mentioned, but they were committed to the care of Joseph by the captain of the guard. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 40. These two servants of Pharaoh were in prison, and as circumstances would have it, they were troubled in prison by dreams they could not interpret. But Joseph steps in and directs them to God as the only means to give knowledge about such things. Joseph offers to help, but he also asks for help from the butler. Let's pick it up in verse 14 of Genesis 40. Read verses 14 and 15. It says, "But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." And so Joseph interprets both of their dreams. For the butler, he would be restored in 3 days to his former position. But for the baker, he would meet his end. And it turned out just as God revealed it to Joseph. Before moving on, there's an interesting point to consider in what we just read in verses 14 and 15. Notice how tender Joseph asks the butler for help. He recounts that he was taken away from his people, and he didn't do anything worthy of his prison sentence. But what doesn't he say? He does not speak of his enemies. He makes no mention of his brethren who sold him into slavery. He makes no mention of the wife of Potiphar. His words are without accusation. And it begs the question for all of us. Will I, like Joseph did, wait? Will I wait on God to plead my case and bring justice? Do I trust him to do that? Will I wait? Jesus Christ, in teaching the 12 apostles, tells them about the realities of life, a life committed to God. And this reality includes persecution. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus states that even family members are capable of the worst kinds of betrayal. But he also said something else. He said, "He who endures to the end will be saved." He who endures to the end will be saved. Joseph was betrayed by his brothers, people he trusted, or at least people he should have been able to trust. But even the butler betrayed him and forgot about him for 2 years after the butler's release. 2 years. It wasn't until Pharaoh had a troubling dream, of which none of the magicians or wise men in Egypt could interpret, that the butler remembered. And the butler then related to Pharaoh how Joseph interpreted his dreams 2 years ago. Joseph at this time is 30 years old. He's 30. Let's continue in Genesis chapter 41, and we'll pick up the story in verse 14 when Joseph is summoned by Pharaoh. Genesis 41, verse 14. We'll read 14 through 16. "Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it.' So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, 'It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace.'" And so Joseph heard Pharaoh explain his dream. And with God's direction, Joseph interpreted the dream. The dream was about a vision representing 7 years of harvest plenty and 7 years of famine thereafter. How did it turn out for Joseph? Let's continue in verse 39. Genesis 41:39. "Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, There is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Joseph is elevated. He is elevated to second in command of all of Egypt. Just like that, God delivered Joseph out of prison, gave him a new position with freedom, great responsibility, physical blessings, and a restored reputation. But the story doesn't end there. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 45. In the chapters that precede this, Joseph is used by God to store grain in the years of plenty and sell grain in the years of famine. And Joseph's family came to Egypt to buy grain. And when they came, Joseph recognizes his brothers, but he did not reveal himself to them at first. And we find that Joseph first tested their attitudes, deals a little bit roughly with them. But when he hears their sorrow and distress, he forgives them from the heart. Let's pick it up in verse 3, when all of that changed, a time when Joseph is now about 39 years old. Genesis 45, we'll read verses 3 through 5. "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Does my father still live?' But his brothers could not answer them, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come near to me.' So they came near. Then he said, 'I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life.'" And so Joseph forgave his brothers. Joseph showed mercy, even when he had great power. And Joseph gives God the credit for bringing good from intended evil. And if we were to read on, we would see that Pharaoh opens the doors of generosity to Joseph's family. As it states in the latter part of verse 20, "The best of all the land of Egypt is yours." How does this story of virtue and trust in God end? It ends with the reconciliation of the family. It ends with healing, the restoration of what was broken. And it points to what Jesus Christ is at work doing as the reconciler of all humanity, the plan of God that ultimately preserves life. It ends with what we are all waiting for. And this story of Joseph is but one. It is but one exhibition of the wisdom and the power of God, of how God brings good from intended evil, how he overrules evil plans and works them out to his perfect will and designs, and fulfills yet again the promise of Romans 8:28 that all things work together for good to those who love God. As we conclude, I'd like for us to turn to Psalm chapter 37. Psalm chapter 37. And we will read about trust and virtue and the rewards for those willing to wait on God. Psalm 37. And we'll read verses 3 through 9. It says, "Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your justice as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret, it only causes harm, for evildoers shall be cut off. But those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth." Joseph experienced severe and unexpected changes to his world. Yet just as affliction did not sink him into despondency, neither did prosperity destroy his humility or his trust in God. And in the course of all of this, over all of these years, Joseph waited. He waited on God. May we also be a people that trust, that demonstrate great trust in God. May we be a people of virtue, a people that wait on Him. For at the appropriate time, God will lift us up. He will bring justice. It's promised. And He will fulfill His plan, not only for us, but for all mankind.